This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
One family trying to avoid the poisoned water coming out of the tap in Flint, Michigan. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl, who is out on assignment. It's Thursday, January 14th. I am delighted to be with you today. Now, if you're not one of the several people who apparently won the Powerball jackpot last night, take comfort in at least a little green on Wall Street today. Stocks rallied after yesterday saw the biggest price decline since September. All three big indices were down about 10% from their recent peaks, and analysts started to use the C word. Correction. Wherever the market is headed in the longer term, it is helpful to have some perspective. And it turns out that corrections used to be pretty common. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
Everyone pretty much agrees on what counts as a correction.
People have decided that a correction is when the stock market by some index loses 10% from its peak.
That's Columbia University finance professor Charles Jones. Why 10%?
It's completely arbitrary. It's, you know, people like round numbers, and 10% decline seems like, a pretty substantial and round number.
It's also completely normal, or used to be. We'll get to that in a moment. Market strategist Quincy Crosby with Prudential Financial says when the stock market gets overheated, a correction cools things down. And yet?
It scares the daylights out of everyone.
That's partly because, for a while, there weren't a lot of corrections while the Federal Reserve was propping up the market by keeping interest rates near zero. Crosby says market pullbacks typically happen about every year or so. But before the most recent one, last summer, it had been almost 4 years.
You would have thought that the pullback in August was 1929 all over again. Everyone had forgotten that is part of the market.
And that it doesn't say a whole lot about the actual economy. William Delwich is an investment strategist with Robert W. Baird. He says there may be a lot of uncertainty about oil prices and the slowdown in China, but the U.S. economy is doing fine.
From a macro perspective, not much has changed over the past few weeks. And so this is one of those time periods where there's a disconnect between the stock market and the overall economy.
However healthy a stock market correction may be, though, research has shown that investors hate losing money even more than they like making it, which is why Delwich says those of us watching these market swings are better off just looking away. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
GoPro having a tough go yesterday as well. The maker of wearable cameras had one of those days you'd want to erase from a memory card. The stock tanked in frenetic after-hours trading when GoPro said it would cut 7% of its 1,500-person workforce. Sales last quarter down almost $200 million from a year ago. So let's rewind back to when GoPro first went public in 2014, and it and its users were climbing to new heights. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports on GoPro's rise and fall.
Remember the first GoPro commercial you saw? Maybe it was snowboarder Sean White on the halfpipe. Justin Haugen was impressed. He's a professional photographer in Tucson and bought his first one in 2013, but...
I kind of think of the GoPro as a one-trick pony, but it's a one-trick that it does very well.
Here's what GoPro admitted to in its IPO filing in 2014. We depend on sales of our capture devices for substantially all of our revenue, and any decrease in the sales of these products would harm our business. Kathleen Smith is principal of Renaissance Capital, focusing on IPOs. She says companies legally have to tell investors about possible obstacles.
Because in the case of GoPro, it has run into some of these risks it set forth in the prospectus.
Revenue risks and also established companies like Samsung, Apple, Panasonic, and Sony getting into the camera market. But there was a lot of momentum when GoPro debuted.
And investors got so excited to see how fast the company grew.
At its peak, GoPro stock hit more than $90. Today it closed at $12. So how does GoPro regain that momentum? After all, it's sold close to 15 million cameras. Nizar Tarhani is an analyst at PitchBook Data.
You know, they're in that place right now where they understand, look, the units aren't going out the door the way they used to be, and they have to get to a place where they can bridge and get the content that their products capture and be able to get that on a platform that they can monetize.
Which, Tarhani says, means finding the right medium, be it with content or software, to get people to buy their cameras. I'm Ady Euler for Marketplace.
You know, as it happens, other companies have highlighted their future problems in their IPO filings. We've collected some of those prescient risk factors over at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, the sky is unfalling. We'll have more when we do the numbers. The city of Flint, Michigan is in a state of emergency. Michigan's governor says the city tried to save money by temporarily using the Flint River as a water source. But the river water corroded pipes, and then the pipes contaminated the water with lead and copper. Kids are getting lead poisoning, adults too. Now the governor says there's been an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease near Flint. The National Guard just started delivering bottled water there, and the federal government is investigating whether Michigan knowingly let people use the contaminated water. From WDET in Detroit, Quinn Kleinfelter looks at what this has meant for one family in Flint.
The kitchen sink in 37-year-old Melissa May's modest two-story house in Flint looks like any other. But she says in Flint, water has become the enemy.
Hot water condenses the metals and contaminants and releases them into steam. So then you breathe it in and you inhale it, you know, it absorbs through your porous, like your feet. So that's why I don't allow hot showers. I had to send my husband to go get a case of water today, otherwise I'm not going to be able to make dinner.
The Mays family has joined two lawsuits against the city and the state. Melissa Mays says her family spends roughly $100 a week on bottled water now. They drink it, cook with it, and pour cups of it over their heads to bathe. But before they switched, they were using water out of the tap, and they started noticing shortly after that something was wrong.
I got this big, giant rash on my cheekbone. It was like a chemical burn, and turns out it was a chemical burn.
But the biggest worry for her is her three sons, ages 11 to 17. Flint pediatrician Mona Hannah Atisha began noticing last fall that the lead levels in the blood of some of Flint's children was double, sometimes triple, the amount it was before the water switch.
And when pediatricians hear anything about lead, we freak out. It affects your cognition, it lowers your IQ, and it affects your behavior. It's even been linked to criminality.
She says even after Flint was forced to switch back to its original water source, the corrosive river water had already stripped away the coating protecting Flint's pipes.
You can think about it, you know, we're still drinking through like a lead-painted straw, and every so often a little bit of chip or scale is going to come off and get into the drinking water.
In fact, the EPA says there's no safe lead blood level in children and that kids 6 and younger are particularly vulnerable. Melissa May says blood tests show her children have elevated lead levels. Their grades have slipped since the water switch.
I worry because they're going to need tutors because I don't want them to just be set aside and saying, okay, well, you know, your IQ is a little lower. No, I want them to be where they were before this happened.
The water began smelling bad and looking funny in April of 2014, right after the city changed to using the Flint River as a drinking source. That's when an unusual number of people began getting sick. Medical bills began to mount for Mays and her children. She's still employed, and her husband is working two jobs 7 days a week. But she says water is always on her mind now, and her children's, especially 11-year-old Cole.
Hey, Cole, when we go to a restaurant or we go anywhere, what's the first question you ask them?
Does it have any Flint water in it?
Daily life in Flint has drained Melissa May's family savings.
We went through three water heaters, and they're $500 a pop, and that was it, because the rest of it's gone towards medication.
And May says moving away from her house in Flint is not an option.
We're not going to be able to sell it, for one, because it's not legal to sell your home with known copper and lead problems until you replace those problems. So there's that thousands of dollars to do the service line and indoor plumbing. And, yeah, nobody wants to buy a poison water house.
Instead, Mays joined the two lawsuits. The family is a lead plaintiff in one of them, a class action suit filed by attorneys working pro bono. The state won't comment on pending litigation.
I blame the city of Flint. I blame the governor, everybody who had any hand in this, you know, to save money. But at the end of the day, when I go to sleep, I cannot forget that I'm the one that handed the water to the kids.
The true price for Flint's attempt to save money by using river water remains unclear. Experts say the full effects of lead poisoning often cannot be seen until 5 years after exposure. In Flint, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter for Marketplace.
If you ask someone from New York, they might tell you that everything in New York is bigger and better there than anywhere else in the world. Well, today at least, that became true in the market of dinosaurs. The American Museum of Natural History opened a new Titanosaur exhibit featuring a whopping 122-foot-long creature. It is longer than the great blue whale. It is so long that the dinosaur's neck actually has to curve around a corner inside the museum. But, like, are giant dinosaurs still all that? Do they really sell more tickets or dinosaur tchotchkes? We asked Marketplace's Scott Tong from the Marketplace Dinosaurnomics desk to look into that.
If you're a serious scientist at the American Museum of Natural History, you answer a money question this way.
It's not just a, you know, dollars and cents kinds of thing.
Mark Norell is paleontology chair. Still, he says the museum does do what he calls market evaluation.
The great majority of people, when they identify this place with something, it is identified with dinosaurs.
That's what brings people in, at $22 for adults, $12.50 per kid. The museum did not give out budget information, but this exhibit has a special grant and it's not raising prices. The question is, will another giant creature bring in more visitors? You know, the marginal dinosaur benefit. Here's Stefan Meyer at Columbia Business School.
What they have already in their showroom is already pretty amazing and world class. Whether just a bigger dinosaur is going to draw many more visitors, I doubt it.
It's part of a bigger story of financial survival. University of Chicago paleontologist Paul Serino says it takes years to find a dinosaur, then $500,000 to take the fossils and clean, cast, mold, transport, etc. You might make it back in films and exhibits.
The public and their interest plays a big role, so bringing it to them through film, through exhibits, is the motor that ultimately makes it possible. Is it generating tons of money? No.
And yet, you can't sit still. Families visit museums to see something new. So to stay on top, you have to keep spending and evolving. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We know you want to see it, so we've got lots of great pictures and a video of Titanosaur at our website. That's marketplace.org. Coming up?
Coming out of the financial crisis, why did a half a dozen hedge fund guys who really had nothing to do with the systemic collapse become the wanted posters for the entire law enforcement world?
Sounds like a great idea for a TV show. But first, let's do the numbers. They're up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 227 points, 1.4% to close at 16,379. The NASDAQ gained 88 points, 1.9% to finish at 4,615. And the S&P 500 increased 31 points, 1.6% to end at 1921. J.P. Morgan Chase announced earnings that beat expectations. The stock deposited 1.5%. Wells Fargo and Citigroup report tomorrow. Wells Fargo added 1.8%. Citigroup inched up 0.4%. Bank of America added 0.6%, Morgan Stanley up 0.9%. We told you earlier about the business questions facing GoPro. That stock slid 14.5%. Oscar nominations were announced this morning. 20th Century Fox landed 19 nominations for The Revenant and The Martian. Its stock polished up 2.6%. Viacom boosted up 1.5%. One of its companies, Paramount Pictures, got major nods for The Big Short. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.09%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. This Sunday, Showtime will debut a brand new series about the fast-paced world of high-stakes investing. It's a drama called Billions. And Marketplace host Kai Rizdahl was roughing it when he visited the set recently.
I went out to New York a month or so ago. It was cold. It was rainy. Found myself hunkered down under a tent on the banks of the Hudson River up in the Bronx, watching the cast and crew of Billions film the last couple of scenes of their first season.
Let's keep rolling. Everybody back to one very quickly, and let's take it from the top.
No spoilers here, but I am going to tell you that the show is right up our alley. It's the fictional story of hedge fund billionaire Bobby Axelrod and the U.S. attorney named Chuck Rhodes, who is trying to take him down.
When I bring an action, not some county or even state. It's the United States versus. Don't give me a reason.
Well, I know who brings an action. And I know what you feel about your perfect record, too. You can't afford a mark in the loss column.
You might recognize the voices. Bobby Axelrod is played by Damian Lewis, who you might remember from Homeland. Chuck Rhodes is played by Paul Giamatti, who you might know from pretty much everything, right? The show is the brainchild, though, of these guys.
David Levine, creator and exec producer of Billions.
I'm Brian Koppelman, creator, exec producer of Billions.
Koppelman and Levine are the team that wrote the films Rounders, Ocean's 13, and Solitary Man, to name just a couple. But this is their first shot at TV. So I sat down with them in a makeshift office just off the set. And David Levine started by telling me how they got interested in high finance in the first place.
For us, the financial world, and specifically the hedge fund world, has so much influence over everybody's life. But a lot of people don't understand why and how or who the players are. So for us, it became a story of these characters.
You know, we'd been long fascinated by billionaires, by what it means to be a self-made billionaire. Because to us, they're American kings, they're oligarchs. And a huge question to us is, what kind of person needs $1 billion, right? What kind of person actually has the drive, anger, emptiness, or what are the noble reasons? Like, we just didn't understand it. And so we would sit with these people, and while, yes, we're asking factual questions, as you do, what we were really trying to figure out, as you are, was why? You know, why can some portfolio manager earn $8 million a year, and like the rest of us, the sane people, think that's, you know, more than they know what to do with. Yeah. And then they're reporting to some fella to whom $8 million is failure. And we can't,
which
couldn't understand. Right. So we're, well, is it insanity? That's what we're trying to figure out. Yeah, you can make the argument.
And there's a television show right there.
Yeah. And so that's a huge. And then the United States attorney side, we would meet people who are high up in the prosecutorial areas.
And we would see that these people were brilliant, and they sort of had similar intellectual firepower to their counterparts in the hedge fund world. But these guys are working for 150 grand a year. Why are they doing that? And what, you know, they're no less ambitious. Their rewards are totally different, and not only noble. I mean, we recognized immediately that there was this hunger for power or satisfaction over the power that they wield.
A good matador doesn't try to kill a fresh bull. You wait until he's been stuck a few times.
We had more than one of these people lean in, and they would say, you know, I was offered $3.5 million to go work at law firm. And we'd say, why didn't you take it? And you would expect them to say, because I'm serving the public.
Right.
And they would lean in after a drink, and they'd say, you just have no idea how much power I have. You have no idea what it feels like to be the person to decide what I'm going to go after and what I'm not. And we'd go, you know you just said that, right?
Yeah.
And so we looked at that world and we were just blown away by it.
They may be cheering now, but believe me, they are dying to boo.
You guys obviously want the show to go on as long as it possibly can, or until you're done with it, which are not necessarily the same thing. But there's some creative tension, right? Because Paul Giamatti's character is going to chase Damian Lewis's character, and it's going to be cat and mouse for however many seasons there are. How do you calibrate that tension between wanting the chase to continue but needing to have some fulfillment, you know?
Well, that's a great question. There definitely is that aspect of cat and mouse, and then there's also the issue of which character people will root for. And the way the show is presented, it changes a lot because neither guy is just good or just bad.
You know, it's
the overlap.
I'm only through the pilot, right? That's all that I got to see. I totally identify with one of these guys, and I'm not going to say which one just because that would be editorializing on my part, but I'm invested in one of them way more than the other, and I was surprised at my reaction.
Right. Well, then you're giving me a hint about which one you identified
I'm
with.
I'm not.
But it would be easy to put a show up that just vilified the money guy,
right,
and valorized the right lawyer. But that seems boring to us and like any number of cookie cutter network shows. We're really interested in the allowances we make for charming, charismatic, successful people. And so we thought, wouldn't it be fun to be able to put that on television and then let that character do some really unsavory things, maybe,
mm-hmm,
and then see how long people want to hang in.
When did it become a crime to succeed in this country? America used to salute the guy in the limousine. They wanted to be the guy in the limousine. They still want to, but now they throw eggs at it.
Yeah, one thing that became a really driving question to us early on when we started the research was, coming out of the financial crisis, why did a half a dozen hedge fund guys who really had nothing to do with the systemic collapse become the wanted posters for the entire law enforcement world? And how come nobody from any of the investment banks, mm-hmm, who are really behind tanking everything, nobody got prosecuted? And we were able to ask the prosecutors that question directly, and they gave us 45-minute long answers,
sure, of course,
about the ability to prove things and this and that. But what they would also do is pepper their conversation with their won and loss record all the time. And, you know, you don't think about it all the time, but what you realize quickly is they don't get assigned their cases. They pick their cases, mm-hmm, so they pick the ones that they can win a lot of the time.
Well, since my appointment, this office is undefeated in financial prosecutions, 81-0, and that's because I know when the time is right.
Do you guys worry at all about glamorizing this avaricious, greed-is-good world that Damian Lewis's character lives in?
No,
I'm not worried about
maybe
that.
Maybe a little bit, sort of.
It's already glamorized, and I think that we don't take an approach that is going to sort of appeal to an adolescent male's idea of what money is for. I don't think that's the way we're approaching it.
Yeah. Right in the pilot that you watched, it's clear that one of the main characters knows that people who work for him engage in illegal activity to get inside information. If you decide to root for that person anyway, that says something about you, not about that guy.
Are you saying you, me now, looking at me? Come on. Damian Lewis is a charming, charming guy. That's all I'm going to say.
There's no question. We're trying to, on both sides of this thing, show flawed, complicated people. And then kings, American kings. To us, both sides of this are really interesting to do a forensic look at. Mm. We didn't want to whitewash it, and we didn't want to demonize it. We just want to show it.
Brian Koppelman and David Levine, they're the creators, executive producers of the new series. Kai's full interview with them is amazing. You can find it on our website, along with an exclusive interview with the show's star, Damian Lewis. Head on over to marketplace.org. Billions debuts this Sunday on Showtime, and the pilot is available now on the Showtime app. This final note before we go, in this troubled investment climate, it can be unclear where to put your money to keep it safe and hopefully get a good return. So what should it be? Bonds, gold, Berkshire Hathaway, or maybe a purse? Quartz reports today that the average annual return rate for the exclusive Hermes Birkin bag has beaten the S&P 500 and the price of gold over the last 35 years. That's a legit data set. The bag costs $60,000 new, and they have sold for $223,000 at auction. That's an average annual return of 14.2%. Unfortunately, if you're trying to keep your Birkin bag pristine enough to auction, you probably can't wear it around. And speaking of exclusive clubs, there was lots of talk today about this year's Oscar nominations, especially about, to put a fine point on it, how white they are. The Carpetbagger over at the New York Times calls it a nearly all-white nominees list again. And it is. And that's not great business. The Washington Post reports that Hollywood is ignoring a gold mine by not making and rewarding more diverse movies. Only 4 of the 25 highest-grossing movies in 2015 had a minority in a leading role. The Rocky spinoff Creed had one of the best opening weekends in the history of the Rocky franchise. Its star and director are both African-American, but only Stallone got a nomination for that movie. Straight Outta Compton is the highest-grossing biopic of all time. Its white screenwriters got nominated for that, and that's it. Oh, and Charlize Theron, who played arguably the best female hero we've seen on screen in years in Mad Max, bupkis. And a report from the Motion Picture Association of America shows that the audience for movies is way more diverse than the movies. Minorities bought 46% of movie tickets sold in the U.S. last year. That's 46% of $1.2 billion. Now, Hollywood studio execs, directors, and Academy voters are overwhelmingly white and mostly men, too. But the numbers suggest they should follow the money. And it's time for us to go. Today, the Dow rose 227 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ gained 88 points, 1.9%. And the S&P 500 increased 31 points. That was 1.6%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I am Molly Wood. We'll see you again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.